harping on wars, be fighting, griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight, old mind, I'm switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought-and-died. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought-and-died key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you run down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning. In the European heartland. This is an interesting article by, by Carolyn Yeager down in Texas. She's something of an expert on World War II, and particularly the ongoing attack on German people and the what's sometimes called the Hollywood version of World War II. I believe today is, I'm sorry, tomorrow. today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, the International Day of Commemoration in honor of the... she writes that this, the Holocaust is the hoax that would not die. It much of the talks in the last week, the last 8 days, given by Monica Schaefer on our Cross Canada in 11 City 13 talk speaking tour, have dealt with aspects of the so-called Holocaust. You see, she served 10 months in a German prison, and her brother Alfred is serving 3 years and 2 months for essentially challenging the Hollywood version of World War II. And, you know, regardless of anything else, any historical interpretation that has to be enforced by jail, you know, if you criticize his point of view, you go to jail, it leaves you with a very strong feeling that it isn't true. you know, no scientist has to enforce the law of gravity against anybody who might doubt it. Somebody doubts the law of gravity or says, I don't believe in it. I think most of us would look with some degree of concern and pity upon that person. But he's not going to be sent to jail because he doesn't believe in the law of gravity. That's not the case with the Holocaust, or the so-called Holocaust. And it raises the question of, well, why? You know, if it's self-evidently true, then why would anybody be punished for doubting it? Because most people will look at the evidence and say, well, that person who doubts it or criticizes it is clearly wrong. Well, the whole thing would be self-correcting, with no individual liberties lost, and so on. Well, why? Well, that strongly leads you to the conclusion that perhaps what's sometimes called the most documented event in human history isn't quite so documented. Anyway, this is Carolyn Yeager's very brilliant essay, How the World Jewish Congress Invented the Holocaust. And you see, I said I would get to her, but I'd like to again digress for a moment. My objection to the endless promotion of the Holocaust is basically twofold. Number one, it's another tribe's history. Now, if Jews want to believe that there were 6 million killed and there's an order from the top from Adolf Hitler, even though that's never been found, and so on and so on and so on, that's their business. I think any group, any tribe, is entitled to its own interpretation of its history. And usually the interpretation has them as the heroes and as the center. Well, that makes some sense. You know, it was history of your particular group, most of it will deal with your group rather than some other group. The difference is, though, we shouldn't have to go along with it. In my opinion, Jews can believe anything they want about World War II. Where the problem comes in is when the rest of us are forced to believe it, or forced to, or encouraged to have memorials in major cities to the so-called Holocaust. There are many other things we should memorialize. Well, that's my first objection. And the second objection is to guilt. I see the Holocaust tales as a way to control us, as a way to make us feel guilty and therefore more malleable. In fact, here in Canada, on the numerous occasions we've been told that our refusal to allow the St. Louis to disgorge Jewish passengers in 1939 led to them being exterminated in the Holocaust. So, you know, if you're against open door immigration, well, in some vague way you're for exterminating people. Actually, no, that's true. Most of the people on the St. Louis who were German Jews, who did return to Europe, survived World War II. They were not, you know, marched off to some concentration camp and exterminated. But the Holocaust is used as a club not only to beat the German people, 74 years after the end of World War II. There's hardly anybody alive in Germany today who was even born before World War II. Why should the present generation be beaten up on because of what turns out to be highly questionable? Anyway, quite a digression from Caroline Yeager's essay. Here it is. Quote, the first and continuing reports that Jews were being wiped out by the Nazis in Poland were supplied to the newspapers around the world by the World Jewish Congress. And that turned out to be a hoax. The first authentic information about Hitler's decision to exterminate European Jews came from an unnamed German industrialist who visited Switzerland in July 1942 and informed a Jewish friend of the World Jewish Congress. And that turned out to be a hoax. The first, quote, eyewitness account of the inner working of Auschwitz-Birkenau gas chamber crematorium complex came from two escaped Slovakian Jews working for the World Jewish Congress. And that, too, turned out to be a hoax. The Holocaust is a hoax that's already been unmasked, but the establishment won't give it up. Instead of a hoax, we could call it a sleight of hand, in the sense of the tricks magicians use. Hoax derives from the magic incantation hocus pocus. We could call it a myth, except that it was deliberately created to deceive and gain advantage, and continues to be upheld for that purpose. You see, it's endlessly repeated for several reasons, but one of them is to gain the upper hand. We could call it war propaganda that got out of control, and indeed it has slipped out of its World War II niche and become a freestanding phenomenon, fueling the worldwide campaigns against anti-Semitism, with ever-expanding laws that forbid speaking ill of the Jews or Israel. And that's what it is. I mean, the hate laws are exactly that. Essentially, to prevent you from criticizing privileged groups. Most privileged, of course, are Jews, but others have been added, blacks and the whole LGBTQXYZ crowd. Carolyn Yeager continues, but it's probably called a hoax because it was deliberately created by a few men in the upper ranks of the World Jewish Congress, utilizing their tight network of influential, well-placed accomplices through Europe, Britain, and the United States. It was inspired by rumors circulated by Polish and Jewish inmates at the Auschwitz-Birkenau work and transit camp located in Poland near the sprawling IG Farben Buna rubber plant. Some of the inmates organized into secret underground networks that maintained wireless communications to the Polish government in exile in London. All this was told in the book released in 1976 by Professor Arthur R. Butz. It was called The Hoax of the 20th Century. And Carolyn Yeager says, which I quote extensively from here and will refer to later. This year, as every year, since a resolution was established in 2005 by a voice vote in the United Nations, the World Jewish Congress leads the way in recognizing and promoting a commemoration popularly known as the International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The media faithfully plays up the day, and governments throughout the Western world pay tribute. Amazing when you think about its reach. This year, the World Jewish Congress has announced that social media giants are joining with them in 2019 to create mass global awareness ahead of the Israel-initiated commemoration day. However, it looks like only Twitter came through. Along with the United Nations, the worldwide media, and major government leaders, the Memorial Museum at the Auschwitz-Birkenau detention camp also recognizes the day with special events. January 27, 1945 was chosen because it is the day it is claimed that the Auschwitz camp was liberated by the Communist Red Army. Yes, it's amazing how much of our reality is created and caused without our decision, but simply our acquiescence in seemingly harmless and usually disguised in moral terms, votes in large bodies such as the United Nations General Assembly, or congressional and parliamentary bodies. In the articles that I have, this is Carolyn Yeager, have previously published on the World Jewish Congress, drawing on the work of esteemed historians and revisionists, the answer to who, what, why of the Holocaust has already been presented. In this article, I will pull all this information together in an attempt to make the full case as to why the hoax of the Holocaust can be attributed to the World Jewish Congress, far more than to any other single entity. We will see that the very first unconfirmed reports of mass shootings of Jews came from the World Jewish Congress, and the final unconfirmed reports of gas chambers and mass cremations came from the World Jewish Congress as well. The World Jewish Congress is the prime institution devoted to propagating the Holocaust belief. That's quite important. Who's promoting this? The World Jewish Congress is the prime institution devoted to propagating Holocaust belief. Holocaust is part and parcel of their other main aims of defending Jews around the world and supporting Israel. That's very important. Carolyn Yeager continues. We will begin with Udo Walendi, German historian, author, and publisher, and his paper published in 1948 entitled Unity in Dispersion, A History of the World Jewish Congress, and particularly the Jewish influences on the Roosevelt President and the origins of World War II. The World Jewish Congress is an openly Zionist organization. Its name echoes the first World Zionist Congress held in Basel, Switzerland in 1897, convened by Dr. Theodor Herzl, a Hungarian-born Jew. Herzl's portrait hangs in the offices of the President of the World Jewish Congress in New York City. In the same spirit of uniting Jews to defend their interests, the World Jewish Congress was convened for the first time 39 years later in Geneva, Switzerland, by Dr. Stephen S. Wise, another Budapest-born offspring of rabbis who was brought to New York as an infant. At this Congress, of which they bragged of having 230 delegates representing 32 countries around the world, the vast majority, or 181, were from the United States, Poland, Romania, and Great Britain. From seven countries, there was only one delegate, and from the rest, between 2 and 10. The center of worldwide Jewish interest and leadership had moved to the United States after World War I, partly because of the large Jewish population. Prior to this first Congress in 1936, a preparative World Jewish Conference was held in August 1932, also in Geneva. It was chaired by Dr. Nahum Goldman, a Russian-born Jew who grew up in Germany. Some anti-Zionist German Jewish groups refused to participate. Goldman defined the purpose as to establish a legitimate collective representation of all 16 million Jews in the world. At this conference, Nahum Goldman and Stephen Wise were entrusted with the leading positions. At first, we have temporarily lost this for a second. At two more preparative conferences in 1933 and 1934, the rise to power of National Socialism became a main subject. Also in 1936, Samuel Untermeyer, who had called for a holy war against Germany in 1933, founded a World Anti-Nazi Council to fight for human rights. That's what it was called, the World Anti-Nazi Council to fight for human rights. He partnered with British Unionist Walter Citrine, and the council served as an agent for psychological warfare and concealed from the public, was to be financed by the World Jewish Fund. Winston Churchill became one of its activists, and he was very keen on going to war with Germany. At the 1936 conference, Nahum Goldman made the radical announcement that the existing sovereignty of nations should be considered obsolete. See, they're big internationalists, they're deadly opponents of nationalism, except, of course, for Israel. The League of Nations should be reinforced militarily, apparently, to safeguard the interests of the weaker groups in the world, he said. By these weaker groups, he meant, of course, Jews. Millions of Jews in Eastern Europe are being disenfranchised and terrorized in the name of the supremacy of the state and the dominant nation, he said. Quote, where the equal rights of a Jewish community are affected, it becomes of common worldwide Jewish interest. Surrender of Jewish rights anywhere equals surrender everywhere, he said. We know that we can only succeed by joining forces with the many others of the world who must fight with us. Goldman also said that mankind had to fight against an aggression that was started by Germany, emphasizing that fighting against Hitlerism is one of the most important tasks and that anti-Semitism must be branded as an international crime. Now, get your head around that. So in other words, criticizing Jews should be a crime. Lev Davidovich Bronstein, otherwise known as Stalin, in communist Russia, anti-Semitism was a capital offense. That's right. To seriously criticize Jews was to actually put yourself in risk of being killed. You know, so much for freedom of speech. Goldman also stated that propaganda is at present one of the main instruments of foreign politics, with boycotts and international intelligence services required to be used as weapons. Remember, this was in 1936, when Hitler was still being admired for bringing Germany back to economic health. I mean, there are many objective people, like Canada's then Prime Minister, William Lyon Mackenzie King, said something roughly to the effect, we must study more closely what Mr. Hitler has done and how he's accomplished it, basically the economic miracle in Germany. Goldman became president of the Permanent Administrative Committee and Wise president of the Executive Committee. In July 1940, the World Jewish Congress moved its headquarters to New York City, with the Geneva office continuing to exist under 29-year-old Dr. Gerhard Riedner and Dr. Abraham Silberschein, maintaining contact with German-occupied countries and the International Red Cross. In 1941, another section of the World Jewish Congress was founded as the Institute of Jewish Affairs. It was assigned the task of gathering information from all parts of the world concerning Jewish affairs, with the aim of submitting Jewish demands at the peace conference at the end of the hostilities. The Jews were looking to get as much as they could out of the war, a war in which they knew very well they were not physically fighting. They thus wanted to emphasize their losses as Hitler's potential political victims. You see, much of this was just an elaborate maneuver for advantage, for money or for the granting of other demands. This has to be seen. In order to situate themselves, they decided to consider the period from 1919 to 1939 as an armistice, not a peace. They stressed that a basis must be created by which war crimes could be punished retroactively from 1933. And of course, they would be the victims of those war crimes. They're already beginning to try to forge the order that they would want to impose at the end of the war. Of course, the United Nations, internationalism, and the only ongoing persecution of the German people, which actually goes on to this very day. There are still, you know, 95 or 96 year old men being dragged off to prison in Germany for the remotest participation in whatever did or did not happen at places like Auschwitz. In fact, not very long ago, a man who had been, I believe, a financial clerk at Auschwitz, somebody in accounting, had never had anything to do with anybody being hurt or any policies. He was a bookkeeper. Was dutifully sent off to jail. This is a form of insanity. In 1942, the advisory staff for European Jewish matters of the Institute of Jewish Affairs met in coordination with the World with the World Jewish Congress. Here, a demand was made for the first time that no peace negotiation should ever be carried out without representatives of the World Jewish Congress participating. Yeah, but they weren't fighting. Talk about nerve. The Institute of Jewish Affairs entertained close relations with the Geneva office and the British section of the World Jewish Congress in London. The British section had built up a research staff of over 30 experts, allowing the Institute to compile a remarkable amount of material, including thousands of documents, press reports, papers, projects, drafts, and manuscripts for printing. Some of the most important publications are Zorach Rohrhaftig, Starvation Over Europe, 1943, Jews in Nazi Europe, Where Shall They Go, 1941, Hitler's 10-Year War on the Jews, 1943. This book made a tremendous impression on the Allied governments and served as a basic textbook for the Nuremberg military tribunals, which of course were not really a court, but really just Victor's Vengeance. An important paper transmitted to the American authorities was, quote, was the conspiracy against the Jewish people, the main chapters of which were headed, one, the originally conceived plan of extermination of the Jewish people, two, the different stages of the crime against the Jewish people, and three, the responsibility of individuals and organizations in Germany. In Europe, in January 1942, the National Committee of Free France convened for a discussion on German war crimes, but not one reference was made to the crimes against the Jews. So in February, the World Jewish Congress asked for a specific statement with reference to the many and special crimes against the Jews. It took 3 months before the president of the Conference on Crimes, General Władysław Sikorski, replied that specifically referencing the Jews might be the equivalent of recognizing racial theories that we all reject. Touché. We can see that from this that not everyone was on the same page about who were the victims of the Germans. Since the Poles evidently did not want to feature the Jews went around them. After that rejection, the British section of the World Jewish Congress in June organized their own conference of the press of the free world, where, quote, facts of systemic extermination of European Jewry were announced, but not revealed in the conference minutes. This would have been the first suggestion of extermination of Jews. This is 1942. Immediate reactions occurred in Britain and abroad. The British Broadcasting Corporation had transmitted this type of news for the first time, and there were mass demonstrations in the U.S., organized by Jews, of course, addressing war crimes and the need for the rescue of European Jewry. On July 21, 1942, Prime Minister Winston Churchill sent a message to a meeting held in Madison Square Gardens, which contained the following. The Jews were Hitler's first victims, and ever since they have been in the forefront of resistance to Nazi aggression. The World Jewish Congress trying to get this back here. bounced off my screen. The World Jewish Congress said they want all Jews to be accepted as one nation represented by the World Jewish Congress. Sensing an opportune time on August 8, 1942, young Gerhard Riedner, as secretary of the he, of course, had been in Switzerland, Riedner, excuse me, receiving alarming reports stating that in the Führer's headquarters a plan had been discussed and is under consideration, according to which all Jews in countries occupied or controlled by Germany, numbering 3.5 to 4 million, should, after deportation and concentration in the East, be at one blow exterminated in order to resolve once and for all the Jewish question in Europe. Now, that's maybe one of the first allegations of some sort of master plan. Action is reported to be planned for the autumn. Ways of execution are still being discussed, including the use of prussic acid. We transmit this information with all the necessary reservations, as exactitude cannot be confirmed. Our informant is reported to have close connections with the highest German authorities, and his reports are generally reliable. Please inform and consult New York. Now, this is the first time that talk of a future extermination was reported. So, an anonymous report, and supposedly not the first from this source, the British Foreign Office took its time forwarding the telegram, calling for it to be investigated first, and the State Department was also very wary. It wasn't until 3 weeks later, on August 28th, that it reached Stephen Wise, who's the World Jewish Congress president in New York, who decided not to make it public. But this telegram is what the World Jewish Congress and its acolytes used to say the U.S. and U.K. governments knew from 1942 to the Jews were being exterminated. But there was no confirmation whatsoever. Anyway, it was some of this thin stuff that got the ball rolling. The informant in this case is the mysterious German industrialist that Bradley Smith wrote about and concluded did not exist. And he didn't, until 40 years later, in October 1983, when it was claimed in the New York Times, again without evidence, that he was Eduard Schulte, a mining company executive who died in 1966 in Switzerland. 20 years after his death, the death of his first wife and one of his sons, and most of those who could contradict the story, Schulte is named as the informer, when nobody can confirm it. Even Gerhard Riedner, a lifelong World Jewish Congress executive, refused to confirm Schulte for the New York Times, reportedly using his excuse that, quote, "I've not identified the man for 40 years, and I see no reason to keep the one request he ever made to me." it comes down to somebody who actually may not even have existed, or that this man may not have been an informant at all. The mass of biographical and business information written in the New York Times article and this was the obituary. That appeared in the New York Times. Uh, um, All very, very peculiar, you know. Very, very peculiar indeed. This was the beginning, the supposed basis of these stories of extermination. The Allies would be accused of having known about this, but done nothing. The very beginning of all the guilt and so on. But there may have been nothing that they could, there may have been nothing for them to do something about. Anyway, she says, this is Caroline Yeager, the mass of biographical and business information written in the Times article is in no way evidence for the claim. Its only purpose is being there to make it appear to those who don't actually read that this is a big story with a lot of information behind it. There isn't. There is none. But the current World Jewish Congress leadership thought it worthwhile to bolster their claim of inside information about extermination plans coming directly from Adolf Hitler as early as 1942 by supplying the name of a real person 40 years after the fact. Without a source given for it, the sentence that Schulte was the first to tell the world about the extermination of Jews has been added to Wikipedia pages. This attempt to fool the public is in itself evidence that there never was an informant, that the story was an invention of Gerhard Wiedner and his World Jewish Congress allies. At the World Jewish Congress website, this article characterizes the worth of the telegram far beyond what it actually was. Note the words reliable and authoritative in the first paragraph, neither of which are at all are appropriate, since it was hearsay. The making of the War Refugee Board. From 1942 to 1944, the World Jewish Congress continued to send messages to the State Department with information from anonymous sources about atrocities taking place against Jews in German-occupied Europe. Many were quite similar to the debunked false stories from World War I, and this was noted by the Department of State. See, stories about shrunken heads and human lampshades, made out of human skulls, human flesh, actually go back to the First World War. And were actually fairly quickly debunked by the middle of the 1920s. That was actually quite healthy. Wartime propaganda often occurs, and it's healthy after the hostilities are over, that a balance is created and the truth comes out. But that has not happened after World War II. So initially, these were the same discredited stories from World War I. A conflict developed between the State Department and the U.S. Treasury Department, headed by a Jew named Henry Morgenthau Jr., who was good friends with the leadership of the World Jewish Congress. A particular disagreement was over a plan to ship 7,000 Romanian Jews to Palestine at the cost of about $1,200 per person. Apart from who would pay for the money and how there were British objections to admitting the Jews to Palestine, and there were still patriots in Britain who did not want to betray the Palestinian population, which were both Christian and Muslim, by importing these foreigners. The State Department found it problematic, while Treasury and the World Jewish Congress were pressing for the proposed project, insisting that the only alternative was death for the Jews at the hands of Hitler. while the Treasury Department had granted the World Jewish Congress permission to send the money to Switzerland in July 1943, the State Department used various excuses, delaying the permission until December, a full 8 months after the program was first proposed. Roosevelt was drawn into the state versus Treasury friction because of his close friendship with Morgenthau, and he backed the Treasury Department. Just as the World Jewish Congress had been pushing for, Roosevelt then agreed to assist in the escape of European Jews with the creation of the War Refugee Board in January 1944. He placed in charge Morgenthau, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, and Secretary of War Henry Stimson. However, the executive director was Morgenthau's fair-haired boy, John Pagel, with Josiah Dubois as general counsel, making it Morgenthau's board. Not only that, but Morgenthau had delegated all of Treasury's powers to the areas relevant to the WRB, or War Refugee Board, to Harry Dexter White, later exposed as, get this, a Soviet agent. Thus, the board became an instrument of Rabbi Wise and the Zionists, and as such, its main achievement was the booklet German Extermination Camps, Auschwitz and Birkenau. Executive Office of the Vice President, Washington, November 1944, hereinafter referred to as the War Refugee Board Report. According to revisionist Arthur Butts, this report constituted the birth of the official thesis of exterminations via gas chambers at Auschwitz. Once Washington committed to the claim that Auschwitz was an extermination camp, the way was clear for newspapers to carry the story. It was placed on the front page of the New York Times on November 26, 1944, with some excerpts given. It is described as two reports written by two young Slovakian Jews, and the other by a Polish major, who had been inmates at Auschwitz from the spring of 1942 until the spring of 1944, when they escaped. And in this, you'd find all the essentials of the so-called Holocaust. You'll read in the Verba Wetzler report, now, that was Rudolf Verba, who was born Walter Rosenberg, and Alfred Wetzler, also known as Josef Lanik. At the end, the authors say, I soon lost my comparatively comfortable job in October 1942 with the Aufräumungskommando, and as punishment was transferred to Birkenau, where I spent 1.5 years. I ask, what did a healthy young man do at Birkenau for 1.5 years? It wasn't known as a work camp. Of course, that assumes that he was actually there. Examination shows that the information in the report is the sort of thing that could have been built up from intelligence data. This is exactly what one would expect, as Germany's enemies had the means of gathering information about German camps and about the events in Europe. The Communist Party, being the world's most efficient intelligence organization, could transmit any information desired to any destination without needing escaped inmates to supply the facts. Conclusion. The WRB report was put into evidence at the International Military Tribunal on December 14, 1945. There was no objection from the defense, and it was accordingly accepted as evidence. However, at the later Farben trial, Farben, a big German manufacturer, the defense objected to the report, questioning the competence and materiality of each and every document in the book, and the objection was sustained by the court. It was undoubtedly determined, even dogged efforts of the World Jewish Congress leaders and friends in pursuing the extermination thesis, that paid off in the end for the Jews. From the summer of 1942, quote, Stephen Wise had continuously campaigned for the Allied governments to take a public position directly condemning the alleged extermination of Jews in Europe. It was J. Breckinridge Long of the State Department who most strongly resisted the propaganda. Long never believed the talk of extermination and wrote as follows. Wise always assumes such a sanctimonious air and pleads for the intellectuals and brave spirits, refugees from the tortures of the dictators, or words to that effect. Of course, only an infinitesimal fraction of the immigrants are of that category, and some are certainly German agents. What we can say for sure is that, in the end, the World Jewish Congress has prevailed, and that it continues to work tirelessly both for the Zionist State of Israel and the welfare of every Jew in the world. What is one hoax, more or less, to them in the face of such a monumental undertaking? And this is all written by Caroline Yeager, who really produces some extremely good work. And I've always admired Caroline's work, and we've even done some radio work with her. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the Fighting Side of Me. I'm going to take my musical break right now, and just looking for we have had our computer problems tonight, but I hope you'll bear with me. Got to take a musical break here, and hope you'll enjoy this. And no, we're not going to, much as we like Merle Haggard, we're going to play somebody else. Well, I hope you enjoy this one. And this is another song that I think you'll like, and I certainly hope you'll like. And this is John Denver, who's unfortunately dead, and this is leaving on a jet plane.
There's no such thing as
Paul
Fromm, a perfect writer.
This is, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. And I'm hoping we're going to get there. We are.
Hey, everybody! A lovely lady, Cass Elliott. How you doing?
Fine and dandy.
I'm great too.
I didn't ask you how you doing.
Well, I like to say it once in a while because it makes me feel
just to
good.
Remind yourself.
Sure. Okay. You know how
that's
it is.
Okay.
You know, I'm really glad you're here tonight because this is about voter registration.
I know.
And I know that you've done a lot of work about that yourself.
Yeah, we're all just getting ready for a big push. This is very important, you know. If I could, I don't know whether who's been talking about it so far in the show, but I've been traveling around the country for the past year or so, talking about our college campuses and trying to find out exactly what people are thinking. And the thing that's impressed me the most is there is still, in this country, believe it or not, after all the talk, a tremendous amount of apathy on the part of people who maybe don't like the way things are going and maybe want to change it, but don't do anything about it.
You know?
And your vote and my vote is not any more important than anybody else's. They're equally as important and very important. And that's why we're all here, to get everybody to get out and register. I don't think it's so important who you vote for. You vote for who you believe in.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing is to vote, because it's our way and it's the best way. And that's why I'm here, and that's why you're here, too.
That's great.
Do it.
Sure, thank you, Dad. I'm glad that you were here to tell people that. You very eloquent lady.
It's a song that I wrote that I'm letting John sing.
I couldn't have said that any better myself.
I'll just walk over here until you're ready.
All right, let's see. Are you guys ready? All my bags are packed, ready to go. I need to wake you up to say goodbye. But the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blown his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. Down. So many times I played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I'll think of you. Every song I sing, I'll sing for you. When I come back, I'll bring your wedding ring. Let me kiss you and close your eyes. I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come, and I won't have to leave alone. About the times I won't have to say. Everybody, kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go.
Was John Denver with an assist from Cass Elliott, also known as Mama Cass. And I'm going to play another song for you. I hope you do like this one. And this is by Rhonda Vincent, and she's a great lady, great voice, and of course she's very good at playing the mandolin. And this is I'm Not Over You with Rhonda Vincent. This is Paul Prom, and you're on the funny side
the world's first six-function multi-port tailgate.
White Resistance Radio.
Available only on the next generation GMC Sierra. Our boldest, most innovative truck ever.
The tears upon my face, and each each time the lightning flashes and I hear the thunder roar, I'm reminded of the closing of the door.
Beautiful Ron Levinson. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow night, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.